Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Nordic Africa Podcast, a series of pod conversations about current trends and issues in Africa. I'm Henrik Alfsson, a communications officer at the Nordic Africa Institute, and sitting here next to me is my colleague Heba Habib, who will introduce today's episode.
Over the past 20 years, migration within and out of Africa has been on a steady rise. Most of today's 40 million African migrants have migrated within the African continent. Of those who have left Africa, around 11 million live in Europe, almost 5 million in the Middle East, and over 3 million in North America. The number of people moving to Africa is less than 10% of the number of people moving from Africa. The migration debate in Europe is both heated and multifaceted, with the EU investing heavily in border control and surveillance, an uptick in anti-immigrant sentiments, and at the same time, voices calling for more humanitarian policies. But beyond the clamor, what are the facts? What are the drivers for migration? With us here to discuss African migration in general and African migration to Europe in particular are Jesper Bjørnsen, Senior Researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Papa Sow, Senior Researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. Joyce de Graaf Aqua, Research Fellow at the University of Cape Coast, Ghana, and Guest Researcher at the Nordic Africa Institute. Most welcome, Joyce.
Thank you.
So we'll start with the first question here. There are many different drivers or root causes for migration in Africa. Violent conflicts and persecution have forced millions of Africans to flee their homes. Many also migrate for economic reasons in search of better opportunities. What are the general trends over the past couple of decades when it comes to drivers and root causes for migration in Africa?
Well, thank you. I think we also, apart from the ones that you have previously mentioned, we see a great number of Africans moving to developed countries because of education. I mean, with poverty comes less infrastructure in education, or just simply because the subject is not being offered in Africa. So when I did a study with Liberian refugees who have returned, migrated to Ghana, I found out that one of the important reasons was that they prefer the educational system in Ghana to that of Liberia. So we find that a lot of, well, now there's a lot of debate as to AI. And if you want to study AI now, you have to go to an outside country. So one of the most driving forces, one of the driving forces is the quest of Africans to seek better education or education that meets their needs. So we can also talk about family reunions, and that's something that I've done with refugees who decide to migrate from one place to the other. They want to go back and be with their families, and you can have a lot of Africans also traveling to developed countries to go and be with their families. Or the care industry, women especially, also move because they have to care for their aging families or their children or their husbands. So these are the three things that I can also say contributes to push people to migrate.
Yes, I think if you want to add things to what she mentioned for the general trends, I think we can say that we have migrations directed towards urban centers. Like in Africa, this is, I think, the famous corridors that we have studied a lot, like the one from Cote d'Ivoire to Burkina Faso or vice versa, the corridor from South Africa to Mozambique, the Nigerian corridors. I think those are big trends that are now appearing in Africa. And then we have the increase of refugees, of course, is in whole Africa. East Africa is a very important area in this domain. Then we can mention the migration routes. They are turning more and more towards internal Africa. I mean, if you studies said like 80% of the people want to remain in Africa, they're not going outside the continent. Then we have what we can say the growing net benefits of migration, the remittances, the protocols of free movement, those kind of things. If you take ECOWAS or you take IGAD in the East Africa, then you have also the partnership programs between EU and Africa. I think those are the big trends that I can mention here.
Yeah, maybe I could add something more on the way we speak and think about migration drivers, because as you said in the introduction, migration and especially African migration has become this political issue both in Africa and very much so in Europe as well. And there is this tendency to forget that when we talk about root causes, we're actually talking about trying to treat a problem, right? We talk about the root causes of a disease, for example, or of armed conflict. So that choice of words suggests either that we're talking about a very particular kind of migration that we then want to prevent or sort of create conditions that stop that kind of migration, or in general that we think migration is a bad thing in a way. Drivers, the idea of drivers of migration can be a bit more neutral. It's used both in research and in policy in a more neutral way. But drivers could also be used in a more positive way, right? I mean, a driver of a car is someone who brings a car forward. But also drivers of economies is a concept where we think about drivers as being something positive, right? So those choices of words matter. And when we then talk about African migration, if we talk about drivers, and let's use that term in a more neutral sense, then I think my colleagues have already listed a long sort of line of a long list of drivers, which range from people being forced to leave their homes, either from armed conflict or natural disasters or other climate-related issues. And then we also have the more sort of economically motivated or socially motivated, as just Joyce said, in terms of family reunion, right? So more sort of movements that have a more positive ring to them. So there's a vast sort of array of different reasons why people move.
An excellent segue into our second question. Thank you, Jesper. So a little bit on the negative side, let's say, of the Africans who migrate to Europe, about 10% do so without official papers or permissions from authorities. Although this irregular migration is relatively small, it has drawn a lot of attention in media and politics, especially the migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea in small and insecure boats. What are the general trends in this irregular migration over the last couple of decades, and how does the political debate topic on this topic vary between Europe and Africa?
Okay, I think here what we can say maybe is we have an increase of migrants without papers, what they call in France sans-papiers, which is also increasing in all these EU countries. This is also accompanied by a violation of human rights. And in Africa first, and then more they go in the north of Africa, you have those violations, above all in countries like Libya, where they have no states, where two states are battling between them. Then we have this dangerousness of the, as I was saying, Maghreb and Marrakesh countries, like they are country of transition. Libya is a case. And the most bitter thing is about the increase of death. They're talking about 25,000 deaths since 2014. I think this is a big number, you can say, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I could add, so there's been a lot of, the attention towards irregular migration, as you said, has been increasing a lot, especially in Europe, right? But if you look, for example, at the number of people crossing the Mediterranean, which is the kind of irregular migration that has received the most attention, there is some variation, but in general, the number of Africa-born migrants crossing the Mediterranean has been relatively stable. Mm. So there's not this big sort of upsurge that we sometimes assume. That upsurge has rather been an effect of particular displacement crises, first in Syria in 2015, then in different countries over the past decade, right? So I think that's quite important to understand that there's not a massive increase in irregular migrations across the Mediterranean from African-born nationals. The other observation is also that a lot of people who migrate irregularly don't migrate over the Mediterranean or across the Sahara Desert. Rather, they fly to a European country and for example, with a short-term visa, and then they overstay that visa and then become irregular. So that's also, I think, important to understand.
Okay, thank you very much. So a follow-up question on that. Irregular African migrants to Europe often become victims of exploitation. You already mentioned that, Papa. What are the general trends in human trafficking over the past couple of decades? And what have different stakeholders and actors done to protect the migrants and to strengthen their often vulnerable positions?
First of all, human trafficking, again, is a tricky term because the vast majority of people who help other people move are migrants themselves. And human trafficking is both sort of a legal term. You can prosecute people for human trafficking, but it's also a word that's used in a much looser, a broader sense. So it's a bit tricky. So most people receive help along the way from not necessarily a very well-organized criminal network, but from a lot of different middlemen and mediators who, you know, help a person get from one point to another point and then pass them on to someone else who can help them continue the journey. So it's much more sort of ad hoc and not necessarily as exploitative as one might think. But there are, of course, criminal networks, and they converge around bottlenecks where migrants gather to then move on. And Libya is a good example of that. And in Libya, there's been reports that different political factions in Libya have been assisting criminal networks to organize their human trafficking efforts. So sometimes that becomes very institutionalized and indeed is very sort of exploitative of the migrants, right? There's a lot of effort being done to combat human trafficking. That has been a key policy issue from the EU, for example. It began already during the refugee crisis, where the EU wanted to expand their surveillance all the way to the North African coast in order to be able to stop human trafficking before people even left the African continent. There are also a lot of NGOs trying to assist migrants who have been exploited by human traffickers, either by helping them return home or by offering them support and, for example, psychosocial assistance along the route. So human trafficking has received a lot of attention from a lot of different actors, which is very positive. But I also want to add that there's been a growing demand for human traffickers, if you want to use that term, in Africa over the past 20 years, because there's been a decline in legal options to migrate out of the continent, right? So with the decline, I think the number of first-time residence permits in the EU for African citizens halved between 2010 and 2020. So when you have that kind of a decline, people are looking elsewhere for options to travel, and they then become reliant on people who could then potentially exploit them through human trafficking. So I think that's important to add to the story as well.
It's very unfortunate. I have a quick question, though, Jesper. Do human traffickers converge more by sea or more by land at land crossings?
There's a long history of migration brokers or mediators helping people cross the Sahara. You need a guide to be able to navigate the Sahara. You know, the desert was called the sea before, right? Because it was sort of a transportation zone for trade from the Middle East all across the African continent, going back centuries. So, and in those travels, there's always been a need for middlemen or brokers or mediators. And that kind of industry is also being used by sort of people who are more intent on exploiting migrants, if you want, and you could call them human traffickers. Also, for example, as a consequence of the European efforts to stem human trafficking in West Africa, Niger has been encouraged to implement laws that forbid people to help people move within Niger, north of Agadez. So it means that people who historically have been making a living as transportation workers suddenly became illegal and by definition became human traffickers if they continued the same services they had been providing for migrants for a very long time. So I think it's a tricky issue. And there are long-standing traditions of helping people move, right? And sometimes these kinds of services fall into the category of human trafficking. So it's a complicated picture. And I think depending on what our intention is, it's important to try to understand the situation from the perspective of people in that industry as well, and not just label everyone as sort of evil criminals. I think it's important to understand also why people engage in providing those services to migrants.
Yes, definitely. I mean, in my experience, covering kind of these routes in North Africa, they're often disenfranchised people themselves who have no other means to make a living. So,
right.
Anyhow, so Next question. Many skilled and entrepreneurial Africans migrate to other countries in search of better opportunities, leading to concerns about the loss of talent, expertise, and capacity building in their home countries. What are the general trends of this brain drain over the last couple of decades? Joyce?
Yeah. It is estimated that a volume of 3.6 million skilled Africans lived and worked in the OECD countries in 2015, compared to 0.7 million in 1990. That is an increase of 90.3% on average each decade. The size of brain drain is relatively stable at the world level, an average of 4.8. The very well-educated, who are defined as those with tertiary education, were the most internationally mobile group. The migration rate is highest for tertiary educated people. I must say the five largest source countries for Africa skilled migrants in 2015 were Morocco, Algeria, Nigeria, Egypt, and Kenya. Hence, the main suppliers of skilled Africans to developed countries are high population countries dominated by Northern Africa. The same countries were on top five in 2000. The AU estimate that about 70,000 skilled professionals emigrate from Africa every year. This is among the highest immigration rate of skilled professionals in the world. African skills have also moved not only to Europe, but they are gradually also moving to the Gulf countries. These countries have developed attractive skills policy, and then also they are having a lot more economic development. Through brain drain, the loss of doctors and nurses, and I think that brain drain is so synonymous with doctors and nurses migrating. This is such a big debate in my country where you have lines, queues of doctors and nurses queuing to take an exam or an aptitude test or just register to leave the country. The loss of doctors and nurses is more extreme. For example, the immigration of doctors from Mozambique currently stands at 75% of all trained physicians. Angola, 70%, Malawi, 59%, Zambia, 57%, and Zimbabwe, 51%.
I think those were some really good points. And I was also thinking about, especially in the case of Ghana, the importance of the health sector as a key sector for highly skilled migrants. I think it's important to kind of, I think that case also shows how the idea of brain drain is a bit tricky to really grasp, because I think traditionally the notion has been that a domestic labor market trains the people it needs for its own labor market, right? So Ghana educates the doctors and nurses it needs for its own domestic labor market. And if those doctors and nurses then migrate elsewhere, then they're missing in the domestic labor market. But that's not really the picture anymore. So a lot of countries in the world are actively trying to educate people for an international labor market. And migrants or people themselves are also trying to hone skills that are attractive, not just in their country of birth, but elsewhere. So in Ghana, for example, Ghana educates twice the number of doctors it needs for its own domestic labor market because there's such a demand of doctors elsewhere. And many of those doctors go to the UK. So there's a well-established connection between Ghana and the UK. This is Paul Collier, the development economist who did this analysis. One last thing on this point is also that we were talking about irregular migration and sort of the migration of African nationals to Europe being seen as a problem. But obviously, when we talk about highly skilled migrants, sometimes they're not even mentioned as migrants because they're less of a problematic category. When you have business people or academics moving to a university in the UK or the US or in Sweden, they're not necessarily thought of as migrants in the same way as people who are seen as a problem. So I think that's important to add to the story.
Yeah. So I really agree with Jesper. So, I mean, with private tertiary education in Ghana, just like Jesper said, we are training more doctors than we can employ. We would not be able to employ them. So there have been instances, and it's happening now, where the health sector is not able to absorb all trained nurses. Mm. doctors, even I have friends, doctors who have still had to stay home for a year before the sector was able to absorb them. So the issue is formalizing. I know there are Libyan doctors who come to Ghana to work.
Yeah.
So Libyan trains one doctor, one home. So they move to Ghana to work. So the issue is about formalizing and not really making this a sensational topic. Just formalize it and then let us know how, because we train them and therefore it's a drain on the infrastructure. As they move in their numbers, Ghana must, or all countries that have experienced brain drain must also increase the infrastructure in training. But if it is formalized, and these receiving countries can also contribute directly per each migrant to the push country, I think this will, it will be good. So we have more, especially with the nurses in Ghana, we have more. It is important that we formalize these processes so that actually we put more money in the infrastructure and training more of health workers, we can also make the gains. So it should be a form of investment, a form of export.
Papa, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think the pictures of brain drain is widely analyzed. I just wanted to add something on the brain gain, as I was saying before, because I think this is also the new tendency we have. Okay, the African continent, they want to also to benefit from the people who are highly educated and who are remaining in the country. And there are a lot of initiatives, like I can cite one from Senegal called Nyoko Bok, which is We Are Together. It is they trying to see all the startup, to put some startup from the African physicians or the high-tech people, and then to see if they can do some project, often funded by Europe, but also they remain in the country. Those are also, we have like an NGO called Afford, based in the UK. They are trying to set up an African business center. I think they did it with Ghana, and they are now setting it up in Senegal. And those kind of things, I think they are alternatives to the brain drain. A thing I wanted also to mention is about when she said we have to formalize it, I think in the past we have formal cooperations like the Tocton project with the UNPD. They did something, so they had to hire some physicians to go to Europe, but they will come back after, 1 year or 2 years. Those kind of schemes, we had them in the past, but maybe we have to renew and do new kind of schemes like this to also allow the mobility between Europe and Africa.
Thank you. So we move on to another question. The African Continental Free Trade Agreement, the AFCFTA, which has so far been signed and ratified by 46 out of Africa's 54 countries, aims to create a single market for goods and services across the African continent. It also has an additional protocol on free movement of people. And I believe earlier this year, it had only been signed by or ratified by 4 countries or so. What impact will the AFCFTA and its free movement protocol have on migration within, to, and from Africa? Who wants to go first on that one?
They are setting up this institution because they want to replace, the complex and ineffective institution that they have before. Like in West Africa, if you take the institution, like, I don't know how they say it in English. This is the financial institution of ECOWAS. And then you have this CEMAC in Central Africa also about the free trade. I think that there were some institutions that were not working well. And I think it is why they wanted to put this ZECLAF and this AFTA. But we have to say also that we have some achievement in Africa. I think they have to take example from those achievement. We have like the OMVS, the Organization for the River Senegal, which 3 countries are taking part, like Senegal, Mali, and Guinea. I think they have a good management of the river, and this is a transboundary management. If I was also talking about this WPAC between Burkina Faso, Benin, and Niger, I think those are examples that could be extrapolated, or they could take examples on those things and then build a new instrument, a new institution.
Yeah. So I did my PhD thesis on looking at Liberian refugees who stayed in Ghana for a long time because of the protracted conflict, and took advantage of the free repatriation package provided by UNHCR. and half return. So that's the cycle. They took the package, they went to Liberia, but have re-emigrated to Ghana. And one of the factors that I found which aided their return to Ghana was a free protocol. You can be in Ghana for 90 days without a visa. And then nobody checks. So a lot of my respondents did not have Liberian passport. They didn't have Ghana passport, but they've been living in Ghana. They've re-emigrated to Ghana for years. So this also helps with migration within the African continent.
Yeah, I'd like to pick up on that. So I think especially for West Africa, we're all, three of us are working mainly on West Africa. And from that perspective, the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement is not necessarily new in terms of free movement, because the ECOWAS protocol has been in place since 1972. So in West Africa, there's been a long-standing idea that free movement is beneficial to the region, much in the same way as the European Union sees free movement within the Union as a good thing, right? It means that people can move for work and education without having to go through a lot of complicated bureaucracy. So this new AFCCFA is expanding that onto the continental level in Africa, which I think has some potential. I think, first of all, it's important ideologically. You have both scholars like Achille Mbembe saying that the free movement within the continent is the only way to move past the borders imposed by colonialism. African people need to be able to move freely to sort of express their ambitions for the future and their sense of belonging to the different communities and so on. Politically, you also have a new re-emergence of Pan-Africanism, the idea that the African continent has to work together to become a geopolitical force and also to exploit its potential. And this kind of a free trade area agreement can help that. So that's sort of the promises or the potential of it. The challenge is, and this is not that different from the experience of the EU either, the challenge is that there's a vast difference in income levels across the African continent, which means that you have regional financial centers like Nigeria, Ivory Coast, Senegal in West Africa, but also South Africa in Southern Africa, where you might see a vast increase in immigration, and that needs to be managed in a feasible way. There's already been incidents of persecution against immigrants in South Africa, for example, and the rise of xenophobia also in North Africa. So that means that you can't just open up your borders and have free movement from one day to the other. You need to address the challenge that people will be migrating from relatively poor areas to relatively rich areas within the continent. And I think that's why some of the wealthier countries in Africa are dragging their feet. They're not categorically resisting the idea of free movement, but they're not convinced that this can be done in a feasible way. So there needs to be policy work done on how to actually sort of go from the existing regional protocols to a continental protocol without risking the rise of xenophobia and sort of problems in integration if people move in large numbers.
Interesting. Thank you so much. And on to a little bit different question. The 27 member countries of the EU are engaged in forming a common migration and asylum pact. Negotiations started in 2020 and an agreement is supposed to be ready by next year, 2024. What are the main cornerstones of this pact and how are the negotiations evolving? Jesper?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important to know that the initial draft suggestion of a new pact on asylum and migration was presented in 2020 by Ylva Johansson, the European Commissioner on migration. And there was immediately a lot of pushback and the negotiations stalled from day one. So for 2 years, virtually nothing happened. There was a deadlock within the European Parliament, because there is this sort of fragmentation within Europe where some countries are arguing that we basically have to just renew and improve on the existing idea of a shared responsibility for asylum and migration. And other countries are saying that that's no longer feasible after the European refugee crisis. So you have countries within Europe resisting the idea that the EU has a shared responsibility to distribute asylum seekers among different member states to sort of take the pressure off the southern European states that are receiving large numbers of asylum seekers. So there's been a virtual deadlock, which is now loosening up. So last year, under the French presidency, we saw a different approach, which was to, rather than just agree on one big package, negotiations were held on different smaller subsets within the new reformed pact. One of the key issues, as I said, is the distribution of asylum seekers. So when people arrive in Greece or in Italy, the old system before the refugee crisis was that their case would be processed in their country of arrival, but that they could then be relocated to another EU country based on a quota system within the union. That system collapsed during the refugee crisis. So there were countries like Germany and Sweden who took on a large number of people fleeing Syria, and other European countries resisting their obligation to receive asylum seekers. And that has just led to a situation where EU member states are now patrolling their own national borders again, which is kind of against the principle of the Schengen Agreement, that people should be able to move freely within the Union. So that's the situation which creates this need for a reform package. There is progress being made now also under the Swedish presidency. So several sub-packages were voted through the European Parliament in March and April, which means that there is progress. And it's still likely that there will be a new agreement ready in 2024 before the next elections in the EU. The problem, though, is that because of the polarization within the EU, the principles are being dragged down to the lowest possible common ground in a way. I think that's the necessary step, is that there won't be the possibility to agree on a very detailed package on how to handle asylum, but there'll be sort of a minimum level of agreement that Europe needs to act sort of in unison to some degree. One of the main issues has been the idea of forced solidarity, which is a strange idea, but it means that every EU member state should be obliged to contribute. If they cannot receive asylum seekers, they should contribute with money and other resources to then help asylum seekers resettle in another EU member state. But that's one of the sort of key issues that is very difficult to agree on. Yeah. So to put it very briefly, there is progress now, which is new. There's progress within the last year or so, which means that the deadlock has been broken. And it is more likely now that some kind of an agreement will be reached, but it will be quite sort of empty of real policies. Yeah. So that will be for a later stage to then negotiate. And most likely you will have alliances within of a select number of EU member states building alliances on particular issues, for example, on asylum or on repatriation. And that's how the collaboration will work.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Jesper. Thank you, Joyce. And thank you, Papa, for participating and sharing insights and knowledge from your research. It's been very interesting to listen to you. And to our listeners, we would like to say that on our website, you can find a reading list to go with this episode. And there you can also find previous podcast episodes. Now we finish off here. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.